Hour. They're also going to have live music, wine, beer, non-alcoholic beverages, community partner tabling, history of Chico Peace and Justice Center, raffle, peace stones, and a dinner, a lasagna dinner. Traditional plus meatless, vegan, and gluten-free. And a program around 6:45 p.m. So if you're listening, this is the time you could be just keep on driving. If you're in your car, you can go, okay, I need to be over at 1110 West East Avenue in Chico, California for the Chico Peace and Justice Center 37th annual dinner. That runs from 5 to 8 p.m. today. Tickets at the door, $45. And a shout out to the Chico Peace and Justice Center itself. They enabled me and others to do a program for a year and a half called Youth for Justice out of the Peace and Justice Center Wednesdays. And for one summer, we did an evening program as well, a morning and evening. It was kind of an overlap for periods of time when the nearby 6th Street Drop-In Center for Youth was closed. And they were a tremendous amount of help. And I still have youth that met me through that program that I talked to on the streets of Chico. And I also can say the Chico Peace and Justice Center, big shout out to them. They are the umbrella organization for crisis care advocacy and triage, which allowed them to be able to write and perform against some grants, some exciting news I think you'll be hearing coming up around that. So the Peace and Justice Center, man, they do a lot of good work in town and arounds. And this is their big dinner tonight. And I think it would be a wonderful opportunity to support them financially and to get to know folks. I guess the whole social hour, they have a bunch of things lined up. For folks just joining, I am promoting the Chico Peace and Justice Center annual dinner tonight, their 37th annual dinner tonight, a.k.a. right now, social hour 5 to 6 p.m., dinner at 6 p.m., program at 6:45, and that is at Chico Masonic Family Center, 1110 West East Avenue, Chico, California. Tickets, $45. All right, we're going to take you back to the very first broadcast of the Lava Reef Radio program, back when it was a monthly program. This is from July 2nd of 2015, and you're going to be hearing from Josh Indar, mentoring coordinator for Butte County Office of Ed School Ties Program, and Megan Malloy, the program manager of that program, as they talk about a wonderful program called Court-Appointed Special Advocates within the foster care system. And I'm also really pleased to rebroadcast my very first interview with someone experiencing homelessness that aired on the broadcast radio here at KZFR 90.1 FM. And that's Kyle Maxson. Still one of my favorite interviews so many years later, or 2.5 years later. Enjoy, and always remember, if you have a roof, be grateful. And right now we're going to hear from both Josh and Megan Malloy on a quick description of this beautiful joy they have for this court-appointed special advocates for foster care youth. It's a nationwide program, and there's offices here in Butte County as well. So enjoy this interview, and we'll be back in just a minute.
You got so excited when I mentioned, I'd never heard of it until today, CASA, and you got all excited. Tell us why you were excited about CASA.
Because CASA it's a really special thing. It's having one person in the life of a foster youth who is going to be there for them through the duration of their time in care. And that's really important because there's so much turnover through social workers. And it's such a very complicated system for a young person to navigate. There's court visits, there's family visits, there's, you know, new foster families. I mean, many times I talk to youth, they don't know who their social worker is. They don't know the difference between their county worker and their ILP worker. And they have all these other workers that, you know, this sort of parade of adults that goes through their lives, and they see them, you know, once in a while. And they're like, what do you do? You know? And so a CASA worker is one person in that kid's life who they know that they can call and ask questions, who they know that is going to be there to help them, explain things to them, or just to take them out for an ice cream or a cup of coffee and talk to them and be a mentor for them. And also just to show up on their own. It's so scary if you've ever been to court, and I think as a juvenile especially, you know, who are all these people? What are all these laws? What are they talking about? A CASA worker will go to court every single time and be there to support that youth and to explain what's going on and to advocate to the judge, you know, for this youth's best interest, because oftentimes there's no one there to do that, and it's very hard as a really young person to advocate for yourself through that. And so that's what they are, court-appointed special advocates, and they do advocate for those youth. It's a pretty great program.
Yeah.
So one thing I wanted to talk with you this morning, Megan, is this whole concept. I mean, Josh actually quoted this, that, you know, that CASA was so, you know, valuable because they were, quote-unquote, outside the system in that they weren't physically a service provider, maybe with a nonprofit or an office space, and they have a mission, and they're getting grant money from here and there and everywhere. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about how important that is to have people that are outside the system helping youth, you know, and manage crisis and their issues.
Yeah, I completely agree that that is the element that makes CASA really great for youth that are in foster care system. I would love to see a system like that for youth that are experiencing homelessness and are out there on their own. I think particularly with this population of youth, systems have failed them so many times, and they build up such a distrust. And then once you start putting all these parameters and rules and boundaries, they can shut down really quickly and feel that it's not really helpful to them. So I think it could be extremely valuable to have someone who's just there as that support system. I am a big fan of mentoring as an approach, and I think you started talking about that a little bit too. There is a lot of research surfacing about the effects of trauma on the brain and on the developing brain, and how that can come out in behaviors. And one of the things that we know is that relationships buffer the negative effects of trauma. And just having that supportive relationship in your life can completely transform the way you experience life. So it's critical. I mean, we know that from our hearts, but now we have brain science that is backing that up too.
I mean, what one thing would you want us to know about your work or the work with youth that are struggling in our community? I mean, what really is on your heart?
Every person is an individual, and you can't judge a person by that tiny moment in time that you meet them. You know, they have a past and they have a future, and who they are right now might not be who they are in 5 days or 5 years. And I think that there is a lot of judgment that goes on when people see someone who they think is homeless. You know, there's sort of a wall that goes up. And I guess that's understandable. But if people can just kind of try to remember that this is an individual and this is a human being, and, you know, you don't know their story. There's this concept of some, like, a Mayan concept of, like, this smoke-filled mirror. It's like when you're looking at someone else, you're really looking into a mirror, but it's clouded by all of these factors, you know, time being one of them, you know, different cultures being one of them, different ages, different experiences. And to try to just remember that when you're looking at someone who looks completely different than you, then you're still really looking at yourself in a lot of ways. You know, we're all just one human family. But I think that's kind of where empathy starts, is to try to imagine, like, to try to sort of brush all of that smoke away and see what we all have in common.
Well, that our radio program made possible by generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Affordable Automotive, locally owned by Mike Button and family since 1996. Affordable Automotive grows their business one customer at a time and can repair or maintain any car, truck, or SUV, ensuring a safe and reliable vehicle. Now with financing available, located at 2106 Park Ave in Chico, call 892-1774 or visit them online at chicoautomotive.com.
Hey guys, Will Durst here with a few choice words about football players taking a knee during the national anthem. Donald Trump is against it. He says any son of a bitch who disrespects our country should be fired. And surprisingly, a lot of people agree. The only argument is which son of a bitch is disrespecting our country more, the athletes exercising their First Amendment rights or a shameless politician stoking division in a desperate attempt to distract his base from the fact that he can't get anything done and his approval ratings are sinking faster than a bag full of nickels in a kiddie pool. Over the weekend, he tweeted 24 times about the NFL and not once about the humanitarian crisis in Puerto Rico. That's leadership, the same way two bottles of Jägermeister are medicine. He even said the owners are afraid of the players and encouraged all those rich white guys to tell their African-American employees to shut up and keep tap dancing. Why would this be about offending the military? Colin Kaepernick explained the reason he started not standing was to draw attention to the fact that blacks are losing their lives to racial inequality. If you want to voluntarily misinterpret it to be about disrespecting the flag, you're free to do so. That's your right. But you should also be prepared for people to misinterpret your statements as being those of a bigot and a racist. And why stop there? The military doesn't have a monopoly on the flag. The players are also disrespecting the birth of the baby Jesus, who was born under the same stars and stripes. Please, people, can we keep politics out of football? Don't ruin Sundays. It's the one day of the week we can tell the good guys from the bad guys, because the good guys are wearing the same shirt as we are, and it's green and gold. Go Pack, go. For KZFR Radio, I'm Will Durst.
Next up is a neat and really powerful interview with Kyle Maxson, a formerly homeless 22-year-old, that reinforces Josh's message on telling your own story is taking control of your life. As you'll see, that is exactly what my friend Kyle Maxson has done and continues to do. Enjoy. Kyle Maxson, I've known Kyle for 2 years, man. Give me five. We'll do that at the beginning.
Nice.
Are you excited about the opportunity to do an interview?
Yeah, pretty excited.
Pretty excited. This pretty is excited. It's not as excited as getting a job at Krispy Kreme, but, you know.
Yes, I did. I did get a job, and I'm really happy about that. Right. Really happy.
All right, Kyle. Hey, I want to start this off because you and I had talked, you know, earlier kind of prepping this, and I had told you the old storytelling, how you need a wolf to kind of dress the story up so people understand what you had to overcome. So if you can give us a little of your backstory about what the wolves wore as you grew up, we can transition to how you conquered your wolves, man.
Yeah, I got some wolves. I was born here in California. I had a brother and a druggy mom. I actually have a little brother, and I don't really know because I never really got to meet him. Anyway, yeah, me and my brother got separated when we were two. So I haven't seen him or my mom since then. He recently got a hold of me on Facebook, just in the past year. And he lives down in Florida. He's doing really well, like really well. He's got a fiance and he's planning on getting married. And so, I mean, I lost a mom and a brother. I went to go live with my disabled dad and a stepmom that I really never accepted into my life. It was a pretty rough childhood. I went from being a bully in second grade to being a complete nerd by the time I was in fifth. And by the time I got to ninth grade, I'd been getting into trouble. Ended up in a group home, separated from my family. And it might have been the best thing to ever happen to me. I mean, it was kind of a, you know, an introduction to the real world. Probably the closest thing until I turned 18. And even not even then, I mean, like, when I turned 18, I got kicked out of my place, and I was homeless. I was homeless for about a year and a half. You know, I tried to go to college. I tried to go to school. I think I dropped out, and I ended up getting in trouble and going to prison. I served a year in Solano State Prison and got out when I was on parole, and I was homeless. I got to tell you, I kicked butt on parole. I got off parole. I got a job. I got a place. I was going to college. You know, I got a job as a bike mechanic, which is freaking awesome. I got to tell you, I really like that. Now I got a job at Krispy Kreme, and I'm going to find another place, and I've got my feet where they need to be, and they're going to hold me up. Life is looking great.
We had this whole dialogue around an excellent way you described this is, you know, being on meth since you were in the third grade. Explain that.
I was a normal kid. I was just a normal kid. I mean, I was getting beaten at home, so I was kind of violent at school. You know, I kind of I kind of learned how to be that way. You know, and you know, violence begets violence. But I guess you know, the problem was me. It wasn't the fact that I was getting beaten. I was the problem for getting into fights. And you know, they took me into a doctor and they got me diagnosed with ADHD, and they had me on Adderall. And you know, it would kind of be like, well, he's still getting into trouble. It's up dosage. And eventually they got me on the highest dosage. And I mean, like, I knew my name and I knew how to do math and science, but goddamn, that was meth. I mean, that was just meth. And I was on that from the time I was in third grade up to the time I was in ninth. I mean, stunted my growth. I was just like a nerdy kid that couldn't socialize, just, you know, I'd skip lunch and just go into the library and read and keep myself away from everybody. And it was kind of like, I don't know, it was pretty tough, man.
One thing I want to focus on too from our discussion yesterday was, you know, how you kind of described things were going pretty well until it was like your dad's kind of like, dude, you're 18, here you go, here's your bags, they drop you off at the plaza. You know, and the reason I wanted to focus on that is because so often, you know, this occurs where, you know, someone's placed out of their home for whatever the reasons your dad had, and now you're like, you're not ready to be on your own. Yeah, I mean, maybe if you could describe that a little bit, how you felt to be dropped off in the plaza with a backpack.
I was going to school. I guess I didn't get very good grades at one point, but, you know, I was still holding in there, and I was still going, and my stepmom told me one day, you know, she had heard from the school that I was going to be passing this year, or whenever, you know, I wasn't going to graduate. I thought, well, hey, you know, like, I've got another 2 weeks, you know, that I don't have to go to school, I'm not going to graduate, I'm going to go have fun. I mean, it doesn't make sense to go to school if it's not going to, you know, it's not going to help me. Which wasn't great thinking on my part, but I found out later from the school that I, in fact, would have graduated, and I was on track to graduate. I probably was just looking for an excuse to go hang out with friends, but, I mean, like, honestly, I didn't expect that lie to come from somebody in my family. So I dropped out of school. When I turned 18, my dad kicked me out because I was no longer going to school. He had me pack up my stuff and asked me where I wanted to go. I said, I guess Chico, you know, it's a little bigger, you know. Paradise is cold, they don't got anything from me, so let's go down to Chico. And he dropped me down to Chico. I had all my stuff, and he just dropped me off at the plaza. And I was just standing there on the curb for a good couple minutes, trying to figure out what the hell happened, you know. Like, I don't know. Your life just walks away from you. Everything you knew is gone, and you're just standing there with a trash bag full of clothes and no freaking clue of what you're going to do. So that was terrifying, to be honest. It was terrifying. I managed to meet some people who were homeless and my age, which was convenient, and didn't know them at all, but I figured I'd probably get the lay of the land by, you know, hanging out with these people. They are the people that introduced me to Sixth Street, and Sixth Street kicked butt. I mean, for the first year I was homeless, I'd use their services for hygiene purposes and communication purposes. I eventually tried to go back to school at Oroville Adult School. I went to go live with my grandma. It didn't go so good for me. I don't know what was going on, but I ended up getting in trouble, and that's when I went to prison. Did a year in prison. And when I got
this time. It's like living in the middle of the ocean with no future, no past. Never been less good right now. Well, I don't wish for it to last.
To go to school if it's not gonna, you know, it's not gonna help me, which wasn't great thinking on my part, but I found out later from the school that I in fact would have graduated and I was on track to graduate. I probably was just looking for an excuse to go hang out with friends, but I mean, like, honestly, I didn't expect that lie to come from somebody in my family. So I dropped out of school when I turned 18. My dad kicked me out because I was no longer going to school. He had me pack up my stuff and asked me where I wanted to go. I said, I guess Chico, you know, it's a little bigger, you know. Paradise is cold. They don't got anything from me. So let's go down to Chico. And he dropped me down to Chico. I had all my stuff and he just dropped me off at the plaza. And I was just standing there on the curb for a good couple minutes trying to figure out what the hell happened. You know, like, I don't know. Your life just walks away from you. Everything you knew is gone and you're just standing there. With a trash bag full of clothes and no freaking clue of what you're gonna do. So that was terrifying, to be honest. It was terrifying. I managed to meet some people who were homeless and my age, which was convenient, and didn't know them at all, but I figured I'd probably get the lay of the land by, you know, hanging out with these people. They are the people that introduced me to Sixth Street. And Sixth Street kicked butt. I mean, for the first year I was homeless, I'd use their services for hygiene purposes and communication purposes. I eventually tried to go back to school at Oroville Adult School. I went to go live with my grandma. It didn't go so good for me. I don't know what was going on, but I ended up getting in trouble, and that's when I went to prison. Did a year in prison. And when I got out, Sixth Street, you know, was there to help me when I got out. You know, they'd give me food. They keep me clean, and they helped me write up a resume. They were the people who helped me get the job at the bike shop. You know, there was a time where I'd been, like, you know, really trying. You know, they saw that, and they put me in a motel. You know, we were still looking for jobs, and I got to stay in a motel up till I found a job. And when I found a job, you know, they helped me find a place. They helped me enroll in college. So, I mean, Sixth Street got me off the street, like, big time.
I actually have to tell this story and maybe get a little backstory or a laugh even. Because about 8 months ago, I saw you, and I was talking about, have you been in Sixth Street? And you were like, nah, it's my fault. I did something really, really stupid. I've been kicked out. But then you're like, but man, dude, you won't believe this. They actually come once a week and they meet me to help me with life skills. You know, how cool is that?
That was freaking awesome. Like, that's how committed they are to, like, really just watching somebody grow and help somebody. I mean, I got in trouble and I couldn't go on the property. But my case manager would still come meet me at the public library and help me type up a resume. And I got a job. I was, you know, still on the street. You know, they didn't have a place to help me, but they'd go out of their way to make my life better.
So how important is it to have adult role models in your life? You know, people that are there to help you, people that are there like, yeah, Kyle, go get him. Or, you know, hey, you need some help with this, or... You know, how important is that?
I never really was around kids my age. So, I mean, I kind of grew up as an adult. I mean, I didn't really have a childhood. It was just, you know, I mean, I didn't have anybody to reassure me that being a kid was okay. So it was just, you know, being an adult. So, I don't know, an adult role model. I think I just wanted a friend, you know? Just really wanted a friend.
That's actually the backstory I wanted to cover. It comes back on the most fascinating part that you and I talked about yesterday. We had talked, and I had kind of said, I don't have a lot of friends either, Kyle. It was kind of like, I don't have anyone I can physically call up today or, you know, whatever. But we had this dialogue around you've met quote-unquote adults, once again, this loaded word, adults in your life, but it's almost like, well, I meet him at 6th Street, or I meet him there, or I meet him here, and it's like they're just doing their job, and that doesn't really seem like, you know, friendship.
You know, for the longest time, I figured that, you know, like, anybody who wanted to help you was, you know, just in it for, you know, like, they were required to. Like, 6th Street was, it was kind of difficult at first with 6th Street, you know, it was just like, you know, you don't know me, you don't know anything about me, you don't know why I'm here or how I feel about it, you know, like, I can hang out with these homeless kids, you know, and, you know, they kind of probably got some backstory that's similar to mine, and, you know, you're just here, and, you know, you probably, you know, you get paid to be here. I mean, it's pretty cool to be here, but you just get paid to be here. You really care about me at all. Like, outside of 6th Street, like, we don't really talk. I mean, like, you wouldn't talk to me outside of 6th Street. I'm a nobody. Like, I want somebody who actually, like, wants, you know, wants what's good for me because they care about me, you know? Like, they feel good that I feel good. Like, that's a friend. And, you know, it was really difficult for the first year of 6th Street because, you know, it just looked like caseworkers helping, a customer or something. That's why it blew my mind when I got kicked off the property and they'd still come out and help me. Like, they cared. Like, that is what helped me. That's what helped me so much. Like, when somebody cares or shows an interest in somebody else's life, that's honestly, like, we are what? Like, we're social animals. We need the comfort. We need the support of other people. So if nobody had shown an interest in my life, I probably wouldn't be right now. You know, I had a pretty gnarly wound on my arm. I didn't care, you know. I was gonna become septic and die. That was the story. Somebody called me up and offered me a week at a motel. I was like, well, I like, you know, being inside. It's really hot. I'll take a motel, you know. I only got 3 days at the motel. Like, she only gave me 3 days. You know, I mean, like, nobody really showed they cared, even at that point. Like, I mean, I did it for a motel, which is really stupid, and that's not enough reason to give your life meaning. But when somebody shows that they care by, you know, spending $50 a night for a motel just so that, you know, somebody else can sleep there, you know, at first I thought, you know, I was just a customer. You're not in it to make money if you're giving me your money. I mean, that, so it showed that somebody actually cared. For that, I am very thankful.
If there's anything that we need to know about Kyle Maxson, it was like someone said, here's $1 million, Kyle, tell me what the first thing on your mind is. What would that be?
Wait, you're gonna pay me $1 million?
That was the first thing on your mind.
Yeah, I mean, like, what am I gonna do with $1 million now?
We got big cameras here. This is like,
honestly, if you gave me $1 million, I'd go fly out and see my brother right now. I don't know what I'd do with $1 million, but I'd definitely go see my brother.
Thank you, Kyle Maxson.
Thank you.
Wow, I get a little emotional when some of these, you know, interviews. I have known Kyle for a couple of years, and it's just amazing. See how far he's coming. I want to give a clap. I, like everyone out there that's listening, I know there's a fair amount of people.